Health and Social Services Committee will now come to order. It is 3:05 p.m. on Thursday, March 29th in Capitol Room 106. Members present are Representative Eastman, Keto, Sullivan, Leonard, Vice Chair Zolkowski, Representative Johnston, and myself. Representative Sponholz, the chair. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business for our friends that are visiting today. If you can make sure to turn your cell phones off or on to vibrate. So we can have an uninterrupted meeting, that would be great. Before we start today's packed hearing, I want to thank Butch Carber, the House Hess Secretary from Records, and Madison Truitt from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee meeting today. We have a very, very full agenda today in light of the fact that we did not meet Tuesday, and so we were going to be moving with utmost efficiency. All right, so today we have a hearing confirmation, for the State Board of Medicine, four bills and a resolution. We're expecting to get a call from Dr. Sang Ling Lu, who's a confirmation for the State Medical Board. She's not called in, so we're going to move her a little bit down the agenda. We'll pop her in when she is available to call in. Second up is HB 193 from Representative Gren, dealing with balanced billing for emergency services. Third, we will hear from Senate Bill 174 from Senator Michicki, covering programs for persons with disabilities. Fourth, we'll hear Senate Bill 108 from Senator Giesel, covering issues related to medical care and licensing. Fifth, we will take up my bill, House Bill 358, dealing with insurance coverage for telehealth. Finally, we'll hear from Representative Gabrielle Ledoux regarding her proposed House Joint Resolution 32. So, very busy, packed schedule. Do we have Dr. Liu on the phone yet? No? All right. So, we're going to skip over that and we're going to move to HB 193. I see that we have Ryan Johnston in the room, staff to Representative Gren. Thank you. Go ahead and put yourself on the record and give us a brief recap of the legislation. I should note that we've previously adopted a committee substitute for this legislation. That's version T, I believe.
For the record, my name is Ryan Johnston, staff to Representative Gren. Representative Gren apologizes. He's currently in finance right now. He apologizes for not being here. So House Bill 193 effectively is a ban on balanced billing for medical providers while also instituting a hold harmless clause for insurance providers, really looking at removing a patient from the billing situation that occurs only in emergency situations. If there's any other questions or concerns from the committee, I'm open for those.
Do we have any questions for Mr. Johnston? All right, seeing none, we're going to take some invited testimony, and I believe that we have Dr. Ann Zink in the room. If you could come forward and put yourself on the record. You've been here before.
I have. Thank you. So for the record, I'm Dr. Ann Zink. I'm a practicing emergency physician at Matsu Regional Emergency Department. I represent Alaska ASAP, which represents the majority of the emergency medicine physicians in the state of Alaska.
Could you let us know what the acronym stands for?
Sure. So ASAP is the American College of Emergency Physicians. We represent about 80% to 90% of the emergency physicians in the state. So I want to thank you, Representative, for allowing us to have this time, as well as Representative Gren for introducing this bill. In the Senate of time, cut down my testimony, and we'll just have a really quick summary, but I do have a bunch of PowerPoint presentations and happy to answer questions afterwards if anyone has any other question. I wanted to make it clear that I come today not representing myself or as providers, but as representing our patients. Emergency department is where we see all failed health care, and this is part of the reason we support House Bill 193. A visit to the emergency department used to be a $50 decision, and now it may mean bankruptcy. We want to care for patients without them having to fear costs. Essentially, what this bill does is it prevents surprise insurance gaps when you're counting on your health insurance. After all, what is your health insurance if an uncovered medical bill happens in the emergency department? House Bill 193 is a legislative compromise focused on protecting patients. It focuses on emergency care, and that's when the patients are most vulnerable and they cannot choose who they see. It's important to remember that the federal law, or EMTALA law, requires that hospitals and emergency providers medically screen and stabilize any and all emergencies, regardless of the patient's ability to pay or what the insurance companies will reimburse. Across the country, we have seen network insurance companies narrow their networks dramatically, resulting in growing gaps between what you think an insurer will pay and what they pay, essentially shifting these costs to the patients. By having this ban on balance billing, you're preventing that cost shifting to patients. However, it's also important to remember that at Emergency Safety Net, we cannot control who we see, regardless of the patient's or the insurance company's ability to pay. If a ban on balance billing goes into place, we must have strong consumer protections to ensure that insurance companies pay a fair and reasonable rate. That rate must be geographically relevant and must be based on fair, transparent, not-for-profit databases that are not controlled by any industry. House Bill 193 protects patients from this large insurance gap and will not destroy the healthcare safety net as we know it. Therefore, as emergency physicians, the people who care for you 24 hours a day when your chest tightens, the car swerves, or your child can't seem to take a deep breath, we support this bill, and we support you when you need us the most.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Dr. Zink, Representative Johnston?
Yes. Thank you, through the chair. So we have pretty much two major providers in the state, correct? Insurance providers.
Insurance providers, through the chair, correct. It depends if how you look at it, Via.
And you're out in the Matt.
Through the chair, that's correct. I work at Matt.
So are you currently in network for either of those providers? Do you know?
Currently our group is in network.
Okay. Do you contract out, or do you have out of network physicians at your facility at times?
So through the chair, our group is a single group that covers the emergency department in Mat-Su fully. We bill as a unified group, and so we are in network with all major providers. Most providers want to be in network. That is our goal. We don't want to shift that burden to patients. We don't have any contract negotiation abilities. You mentioned there's kind of two groups out there, and really in the private market, there's one group out there. We're caring for patients most of the day. It's hard for us to actually have those conversations, so we just take what the insurance companies give us, and that's the reason why this legislation is really important.
Right, but I mean, you're getting bulk of your visits, if they're insured,
are through the chair, correct. Yeah, the bulk of our visits, if they are insured, we're in network.
And through the chair, follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
Other emergency room facilities in the state, let's say Juno, are you familiar how they operate?
Yeah, so through the chair, it's a similar sort of model throughout the state for emergency providers. Most of us are independent groups contracted with the hospital. Most of our, again, our goal is for our patient, and most of us are in network. What you can see in the lower 48 is those networks have really radically shrunk really dramatically, and so we're seeing really large surprise insurance gaps in the lower 48. Much more than we're seeing here, and learning from what we're seeing in the lower 48 is why we're hoping that with this legislation we kind of get in front of that. So you're correct. We don't send very many balance bills right now. We're in network with most. This isn't the issue that is taking down most patients right now, but it's a huge issue in the lower 48, and I believe that this is a big issue we need to get in front of now.
Thank you.
I also want to take a moment to recognize that Representative Tarr joined us about 3:10. So. All right, any other questions for Dr. Zink? All right, seeing none, thank you very much. Let's see, I want to take a see if there is, I think we're ending invited testimony here, and we're looking around the room to see if there's anybody in the room that wants to testify. I also want to note that we have Michelle Michaud from the Department of Administration to answer questions. All right, we'll go ahead and open it up for public testimony. Sorry, I should have done that before. We have Sammy Ali, who's on the phone at the Anchorage LIO.
Hi, my name is Sammy Ali, A-L-I, and I'm an emergency physician at Providence, Alaska Emergency Room. So I represent Alaska Emergency Medicine Associates. We are a group of physicians who staff the Providence, Alaska Medical Center Emergency Room. I've been there for about 12 years and previously worked at Fairbanks Emergency Room as well. At Providence ER, we are a group of 35 physicians, a group of over 35 physicians who are board certified in emergency medicine, and we provide care to all patients who come through the emergency room. We have a longstanding commitment at AEMA to provide the highest quality care for our patients, and in our facility, we don't use any mid-level providers. You will always see a physician when you come to our emergency room. We do that with extreme difficulty in recruiting and retaining quality physicians. HB 193 works to help us do that. HB 193 retains the percentile rule, which will enable not only my group but other physician groups in Alaska to recruit and retain high-quality physicians. This might not sound like a difficult task, but it is a very difficult task to recruit physicians to our state. With the 80th percentile rule in place over the past decade, we've been able to recruit and retain physicians such that we're able to meet or excel at national standards for treating strokes, sepsis, and heart attacks. We've established two level two trauma centers in the city of Anchorage. We now have a pediatric emergency room, which will see your children in a special area. And our cardiac arrest survival data, which means if you collapse with a shockable rhythm, cardiac arrest in the Anchorage Bowl, the statistics show in Anchorage that your survival is better, your survival is as good as, if not better, than most of the other cities around the country. This is because we have highly qualified, trained physicians at every level, from the physicians who train EMS to the emergency room physicians who resuscitate you in the emergency room to the specialists who care for you in the hospital. And we're able to do that through the 80th percentile rule. We ask that you preserve the 80th percentile rule to prevent any reduction in quality of care or accessibility to medical care for patients in Alaska that would take decades to rebuild, and ask for your full support of HB 193.
All right. Is there any questions for Sammy Alley? All right, seeing none, I also want to just take a moment to recognize that we're joined by some of our Senate colleagues, Senator Kathy Giesel and Senator Peter Michicki, this afternoon. It's a pleasure to have you here in House Hess, a little bit in advance of each of your bill hearings. All right, next up for public testimony, we have Dr. Stephen Compton with the Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute.
Good afternoon. This is Steve Compton. I'm the president of the Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute in Anchorage. We're based in Anchorage. We have two offices in Anchorage. We also have physicians full-time in the MATSU and in Solvatna and in away clinics all around the state, including Fairbanks. Practicing cardiology in Anchorage has been a challenge for a few reasons. Just like the ER docs, we find it very difficult to recruit people that come to Alaska. Those of us who live here know that it's a very special and amazing place to live, but it's a challenge to persuade people who've lived and trained in warmer climes that Alaska would be a good fit for them. Alaska is already underserved in cardiology. If we had the same ratio of cardiologists to population, to obtain that compared to the rest of the country, we would have to more than double the number of cardiologists here. So we're already underserved, and we're looking at what you probably already heard about is the silver tsunami. The baby boomers are entering the 65 and older realm, where we see more cardiology care being required. And so the demand for our services has accelerated tremendously in the last decade and will continue to do so. One of the reasons for higher healthcare utilization in the state in the last decade has to do with our demographics, and this is something that no one seems to be paying much of attention to in public forums, but the rate of growth of the 65 and older demographic is faster in Alaska than just about any other state except for Arizona. And so, and there's a commensurate rise in cost of health care. You know, 30-year-olds are a lot easier to care for than 70-year-olds. So a fundamental commitment of the Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute is access to care, and we are committed to provide care to literally anybody who walks through the door, and we do that. We never turn people away. And as a result, between that and the aging of the Alaskan population, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute has become the single biggest provider for Medicare patients in the state. We care for 30% of the state's Medicare population. And as you likely know, every Medicare clinic that has been set up in Anchorage to deal with that population, they've all lost money. They've been tremendous money losers. And the Medicare clinics that exist still are heavily subsidized by the hospitals. And while we actually have an even larger Medicare clinic, and the way we keep the lights on is by cost shifting. And it's no secret that we have to charge and pay for our Medicare neighbors with funds that come from private payers, and that's how we manage to provide access to every Alaskan. And so it's a delicate balance for us, and we are in favor of this bill because we think it helps us maintain that balance and maintain access to care. And so I'm speaking on behalf of the group, and I urge you to move forward with this bill. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Dr. Compton? All right, seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. Looks like that's everybody that was calling in today. Is there anybody in the room that's joined us since that would like to testify on this bill? All right, seeing no takers, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. Are there any amendments to this bill? Is there any discussion from the committee? All right, seeing none, I would entertain a motion to move the bill from committee.
Madam Chair, I move committee substitute for House Bill 193, Work Order 30-LS0466/T from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Are there any objections? All right, seeing none, the committee substitute for HB 193 passes from committee. We're going to take a brief at ease while committee members sign the report. We're going to pick things back up with Senate Bill 174. Would Senator Michiki and Caitlin Stansberry come join us? Good afternoon on this sunny afternoon in Juneau.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Senator Peter Michiki, District O on the Kenai.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Caitlin Stansberry, intern Senator Michiki's office.
All right. Go ahead and proceed with introducing your bill.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks for hearing our bill today. This bill is Senate Bill 174. It allows the Department of Health and Social Services to partner closely with persons with physical and mental disabilities to enable their most active participation in their support services. This bill is a shared vision of over 200 people and organizations, including the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education and the Key Coalition of Alaska. If you remember when they were here for their annual visit, it's their top priority. Person-centered services enhance individuals with physical and mental disabilities' lives by giving them more control over their support services, as well as enabling their full participation in the social and economic environment in their communities. The state benefits from the cost reduction through providing services that meet the specific needs instead of bundling those services inefficiently. It would enable the support service programs to consider the paid and unpaid support of these individuals. Unpaid support is the natural support that stems from the home and community, such as work, volunteer supports, social participation, et cetera. It also provides a long overdue unifying vision to allocate and apply resources in a manner that maximizes Alaskans experiencing disabilities, contributions to their communities. Other programs that some of you have voted for in the last couple of years that are similar, such as the ABLE accounts and Employment First. It's a brief introduction. I don't know that it requires more than that. I just have two more things to say, and that is that Alaskans experiencing disabilities, for those of you on the Hess committee here in the House, they are not cattle. They are not a number. They are individual, amazing Alaskans that have hopes and dreams and want to accomplish the very most that they can in their lives. In the past, when their services have been handed to them without their participation, sometimes they would feel more like the former than the latter. Mm-hmm. And with that, while we were going through public testimony, Madam Chair, Claire's mom testified, and she just reminded us all of something, that everyone with kids are one catastrophe away from needing services, one injury, one car wreck. Any of us could be requiring similar services in the future, and I think we would want the same input that the folks that are supporting Senate Bill 174 are asking for today.
All right, absolutely. Are there any questions for Senator Michiki? Are you going to do a sectional?
Yes, Madam Chair. So for the sectional analysis of Senate Bill 174, Section 1, AS 478009, Legislative Findings Related to Persons with Disabilities, adds a new section, and it presents how Alaskans with physical and mental disabilities, quality of life is enhanced when allowed to actively participate in their support services. Section 2 adds new language, allowing the Department of Health and Social Services to make a more flexible approach in allowing active participation for those with physical and mental disabilities. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And I note there's a zero fiscal note as well. All right. So thank you very much. Is there any questions for Ms. Stansberry? All right, seeing none, I guess we'll go to invited testimony at this time. I believe that we have Dwayne Mays on the phone for questions only. First we'll go to Maggie Winston with the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education.
Hi, this is Maggie Winston.
Go ahead and give us your testimony, Ms. Winston.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the invitation for testimony. My name is Maggie Winston. I'm the chair of the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education. I live in Kenai, and I am an individual that experiences a disability. When I was 21, I acquired a spinal cord injury, taking away all functional use of my arms and my legs. So I had to navigate the disability system within our state in order to receive the services that I'm currently receiving. And these services enable me to live in my own home, to be a mom, to go to a job where I work at a center for independent living that enables me to be an advocate for other individuals that experience disabilities as well. And I'm asking you guys for support today for this bill that just is going to make individuals like myself and family members feel supported with this flexible shared vision for services and for service provision within our state. It solidifies the spirit of self-determination for individuals like myself, where things can seem sort of chaotic and out of control at times, and this is something that enables self-determination and more control, and offers me more decision-making and support towards a meaningful life, which is something that everybody wants, regardless of their disability. So thank you all very much, and we just ask for your support in this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Winston, for your testimony. It's good to hear your voice again. I think we enjoyed having you here when you came with the Governor's Council about a month and a half ago. I think we have a question here from Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Yes, Madam Chair. Just a quick question, if you don't mind. As I'm looking at the sectional, I'm wanting to hear from you, Rebecca, just how this would be applied and how this will assist you in the Medicaid process.
Well, I think, and when we were hearing testimony last week, Director Mays had a really good answer for this as well, and he might be a little bit better for practical application as far as questions go, but what I see is that this is language that will solidify something more sustainable for service provision in the future, so that when individuals are looking for services for the future, that they will have a language that empowers them and enables them to be self-determinating.
Okay, and follow up through Madam Chair. So in other words, it allows that ability for better communication either with your health care professional or with other support services to make sure that you're included with the decision-making process. I mean, is that part of it?
Yes. Yeah, I think that you are on the right track with the communication piece. But even more than establishing better communication, establishes a foundation of self-directedness, in that I don't need to necessarily accept something that won't work for me, but I have now this voice, and I have this statute saying that I'm supported in my individuality and in my needs by my state.
All right. Representative Zolkowski has a question.
Thank you, Ms. Winston. If you can just remind me, because I remember we heard this bill in Community and Regional Affairs, and is it correct in my understanding that were this to pass, this allows statutory support for individual Alaskans to potentially opt out of services that they might not need and have those self-directed conversations with the department to make sure that they do have the services that they do desire?
That is my understanding. Yes, that's correct.
Are there any other questions for Ms. Winston? All right, seeing none, we will go on to thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Winston, and your leadership as well with the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education. Next, we're going to go to Michelle Garreau with the Key Coalition.
Hello, this is Michelle Garreau, and I am representing the Key Coalition of Alaska. I'm a board member. I'm also a guardian of two individuals that experience disabilities, and thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today. Just want to bring the Key Coalition's voice of affirmation to this bill. We've been very supportive of putting into statute a foundational language that is so value-driven and upholds and supports those primary stakeholders across the state of Alaska, and gives departments in the government an opportunity to, as they make decisions, to go back to this value-driven language of, is this system we're designing, is this support that we're giving people, is it flexible, is it self-directed, are we involving people in the decisions? And are we making it easy for people to cross over departments potentially, because there are those that experience an intellectual disability and also a mental health challenge, and sometimes navigating those two different service delivery systems can be challenging. And this statute will enable departments to work together to provide more synchronous delivery systems to people. I think it also sets the stage for a vision for Alaska that, regardless of how much money we have, that all of the money that we allocate to support people keeps people actively engaged in community and keeps them actively part of indicating what they need. And I think that it's just a beautifully written bill, and we highly support it from the Key Coalition.
Thank you, Ms. Durow. I'm sorry. Are there any questions for Ms. Durow? All right, hearing none, thank you very much for calling in today. We appreciate your testimony.
And thank you.
And next up we have Lizette Steer. Am I pronouncing your name correctly?
That's correct.
All right, thank you. Can you go ahead and introduce yourself and give us your testimony?
Certainly. My name is Lizette Steer, and I'm the Executive Director of AADD, and AADD is the Alaska Association on Developmental Disabilities Think Trade Association. So 47 different providers of services to individuals who experience developmental disabilities belong to the AADD Association. And we have been an active and strong supporter of the shared vision, the work that's being done. This vision brings a renewed energy and excitement to work in the provider community. The shared vision reminds each of us why we've dedicated our professional lives to this field and where we want the focus of service to be, which is on the individual that we're working with. We're so appreciative of Senator Merchiki's submitting SB 174 and putting this shared vision into statute. In statute, the shared vision will provide a consistent and strong platform for individuals to lead their own services, as Maggie articulated so well, rather than the bureaucracy. It enriches lives and the fabric of the community in which they participate. Services matching the shared vision will provide for more independent life and greater personal confidence on the part of individuals and perhaps even better inclusion in the community. This will help stretch limited firms farther with greater participation in the community involving unpaid natural supports. Having the shared vision in statute will assure that the underlying philosophy of dignity, respect, and choice don't change with either shifts in funding or with political leaders. Again, I want to thank you for your time and attention and the efforts on the part of so many individuals in Alaska, both providing and receiving services. And again, particularly a thank you to Senator Merchiki for this bill that we strongly support. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Ms. Steer? All right, seeing none, thank you very much for calling in with your testimony. And I think we've reached the end of our invited testimony, and now we'll move to open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify? All right, seeing some.
Thank you for having me. My name is Corey Gilmore, and I do have the honor of working with the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education. And I'm a recipient of services, obviously. And just to give you a little bit of background about what services, what it's like to receive services. We work, services are provided based on a plan of care, which is a very long document all about the kinds of things we need and the kinds of things we do every day and the kinds of things that people think we should be doing. Now, these plans of care are decided in big meetings. So typically you go to a conference room and you sit there while people talk about you. And they will say, 20% of the time Corey does this. 20% of the time Corey does this. I think he should be working on this. And 5 minutes before this meeting is over, they will turn to you and say, what would you like to work on this year? We really need to turn that on its head. Mm-hmm. We really need to make it so that these plans of care are about things that we want to be doing. And we need to be in control of that, because it is so difficult for us and for our staff. One of my staff is here today, and it is difficult for them to have to be going, your plan of care says you will do this. And I have to go, I didn't agree to that goal. It's in my plan of care, but I didn't agree to that goal. And so then, now in my case, I write most of my plan of care, and we want more people to do that. But let's say I didn't. If I didn't, I'd have to say I didn't agree to that goal. And so he would have to put down that I refused to work on it. The more goals we refuse to work on, the less services that we receive. So we need to make sure that when we have a plan of care, that it's our plan of care. And that there are goals that we can all stand to work on, because we hate working on goals that are not our goals, and I've seen many people have to do that. And our staff hate going, yeah, but I have to do it because it's in your plan of care. And I don't know anybody sitting in this room, if I came up to one of you and said, okay, now I've decided what you're going to do for the day, and you have to do it.
Yeah.
And there's not too many people that would go, that sounds awesome, let's do that. So thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Gilmore. Are there any questions from the committee of Mr. Gilmore? Representative Tarr.
Thank you. This really helped me. Thank you for your testimony. It really helped me understand the positive impact that the legislation could have. And I did not know about this link between, you know, if you aren't working on the goals in your plan of care, that you could lose your services.
Yes.
And so just that seems like something we also might want to sort of look at. You know, based on non-participation, is that the problem? If you don't participate, then the services can go away?
So it's not. Now, I have to say, I'm all for participation. Just because I'm sitting down does not mean I have a right to sit on my butt and do nothing. People on the Governance Council hear me say this all the time, but life requires audience participation. Okay? So I'm not against participating. But the problem is that the way that it's set up now, the goals are not participatory. They are meant to be habilitative, mm-hmm. Which is difficult for people like me because I have cerebral palsy and I'm 42 years old, and my philosophy is if I could have been habilitated, none of my staff would need to be here. Just a thought, like, you know. However, I don't, if I can get a goal that I can live with, I don't mind when people say, will you help me out, you know, doing something? Sure, I'll help, you know. I don't want to sit here and do nothing. I need to participate. But right now, we actually don't have the ability to say, no, I didn't agree to that goal. We have to do it because it's in our plan of care. If we don't do it, we could lose services. We could lose, because habilitation is how they justify the cost.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So,
I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Sure.
All right. Are there any other questions for Mr. Gilmore? Thank you very much for taking the time to come in and testify today.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Is there anybody else in the room that would like to testify? All right. Seeing none, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. Are there any amendments to this bill? Representative Eastman.
Yes, and just in listening to the testimony and reviewing the bill, I'd like to introduce a conceptual amendment.
What's your conceptual amendment?
My conceptual amendment would be to, in place of the words, can achieve a meaningful life, would be can be more active. And it already says in their homes, jobs, and communities. And I think that's very much what we're trying to achieve here. And I think that also would remove the question of the philosophical components of the meaning of life, which I don't think we've really gotten into and probably don't want to get into today.
Could you be more specific about your conceptual amendment?
Yes.
Where in the bill are you?
So you two places in the bill, at the top of page 2 and the bottom of page 3, you have the words, can achieve a meaningful life. And so my amendment, conceptual amendment 1, would be to replace those words with can be more active. And so the changed wording would read, can be more active in their homes, jobs, and communities on page 2, and then on page 3, can be more active in their in the person's home, job, and community on page 3.
All right. I'd like to invite up the bill's sponsor.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
What are your thoughts on the conceptual amendment?
Well, I could load Corey up in the back of my pickup and give him a really a lot of activity, but I'm not sure that that would lead to a more active life or more meaningful life, as the words are in the bill. It really is about, it's not about physical activity. It really is about self-determination in your treatment and the most value out of life, how you see fit. Again, you're talking about people, I mean, Maggie's probably the most amazing human being I've ever met, who has a full-time job and completed her college degree without use of her arms and legs. I mean, I'm not sure that it's, in fact, I'm positive it's not about physical activity. It's about accomplishment and opportunity and fulfillment.
I would agree. In fact, I also want to observe that procedurally we didn't move the amendment. So we need to move the amendment and then the conceptual amendment.
I'll move conceptual amendment number 1.
All right, and I will object for the purposes of discussion. And then I believe that Senator Michiki made a very good point, and that the language of the bill was actually drafted in collaboration with the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education. Is there any other discussion from the committee? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And at the top of page 2, of course, I think it, based on just the conversations I've had before with the folks from the council, it seems that talking about having a meaningful life is kind of the language that is used quite a bit. And I think in response to Senator Michiki's comments, for those very reasons, because it is about recognizing that no matter the physical or intellectual challenges or some limitations that you that this person has opportunity to have a meaningful and full life to the full extent of whatever capabilities they have, and we should be as supportive as possible to help them live that full life and experience everything that's possible. And that is meaningful, and I like that language.
Mm-hmm. Is there any comments from the committee? Any other comments? Representative Eastman.
Thank you. Yeah, I very much support the idea of, you know, more and increase and a lot of the other words that I've heard. But the way that the wording is presently achieved, it would tell us that, you know, without this program, the person cannot achieve a meaningful life. And I don't think that what we're trying to get at is to give them a meaningful life when they don't otherwise have one. So I think philosophically that's probably more than we can achieve through this program. There's a lot of good things that may come of this program, but giving someone meaningful life, you know, if we were even just talking about more meaningful, I think that would be an entirely different concept. But currently it is written in such a way that we're saying that they can't achieve a meaningful life without this. I don't think that's true.
All right. Well, I appreciate those comments. And in the interest of time, because we are trying to be pretty efficient today, I'm going to just say that I'm going to go ahead and maintain my objection. And it looks like we should probably take a vote. All right. Want to call the roll?
Representative Zolkowski.
No.
Representative Eastman.
Yes.
Representative Johnston. No, present. Representative Sullivan Leonard.
No.
Representative Tarr.
No.
Representative Tito.
No.
Chair Sponholz.
No.
1 yay, 5 nays.
All right, and hearing that, the motion fails, and with that, I want to ask if there's any other discussion from the committee on this bill. I guess all the Representative Tarr?
Well, I just this bill and the other bill that we considered, and I'm sorry, I can't think of the name, but the supportive decision-making bill, I just am really pleased that both of these bills are coming forward. They seem long overdue, and happy to lend support, and thank Senator Michicki for bringing it forward. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just want to add, I think that I'm the concept behind this that I'm most particularly moved by is the concept that Maggie Winston mentioned earlier, and that's self-determination. And I think about the comments that Mr. Gilmore made and some of the comments that I've heard from other members of the Governor's Council, including constituents that I've heard from. Self-determination is, one of the most important concepts that we have as individuals. Our ability to control our own bodies and our own destinies is very important to each and every one of us. As we were discussing earlier, I think is actually, as Mr. Gilmore was pointing out earlier, most of us don't like to be told what to do. It's hard enough to do when we're a child, and when we're an adult, we certainly have an expectation that we should be able to make the choices for our lives that most fit with our values, and that we build our lives and build our skills in ways that are meaningful to us and not necessarily to other people. And so I think this bill is important. And I would go ahead and entertain a motion to move the bill from the committee.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 174, Work Order 30-LS1258/D from committee with individual recommendations and attach zero fiscal note.
Are there any objections? All right, seeing none, SB 174 passes from committee, and we're going to go to IEs while the committee members sign the report. With that, House Hess is continuing to be the model of efficiency. We're going to ask Senator Giesel and Jane Conway to come up, put yourselves on the record, and begin your presentation of SB 108.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm State Senator Kathy Giesel, representing Senate District N, as in November. That's the Anchorage Hillside and the area around Muldoon. So today, I first of all want to thank you sincerely for hearing Senate Bill 108. This comes to you at request of the State Medical Board. So these are some changes that the Medical Board is requesting for their statutes. There are two elements to the bill. First of all, the purpose of the bill is to streamline physician licensing. I don't know how many of you have gotten emails from physicians who have said, you know, it took a year to get my license. Why is it taking so long? This particularly has become an issue with the advent of our approval for telemedicine. They've had an avalanche of applications. In addition, the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development has done some looking at the various boards and the efficiency of the boards and identified some improvements. And so this comes also with the recommendation of the department. Second topic there is the need for office assistance. So there are two specific pieces of this bill that will talk about office assistance in medical offices. We'll get into that detail here in a moment. First topic is streamlining physician licensing. I'm actually going to be doing somewhat of a sectional as we go through the topic so you can see where these are. So sections 1, 2, 8, and 9 will change the process for license approval. Right now, the reason that it takes so long for a license to get approved is that a license application comes into the state medical board. The license examiner looks at it, makes sure the pieces are there, and then the license waits until the state medical board meets. They meet four times a year. They personally look at each application. This bill will streamline that process by authorizing their executive administrator to actually look at the licenses, and if they're complete, and if they're, I'm going to use air quotes, clean, that is to say the criminal background check is there, there's no concerns there, there's no previous disciplinary issues, all the documents are complete, then the executive administrator would be authorized to approve that license. And you see that in sections 1, 2, 8, 9, and 10. So there's a process there to review the applications and grant the license, in addition to issue temporary licenses if the requirements are met, certification if those requirements are met, and it also spells out prohibitions when the board could limit the executive administrator's authority in this realm. I will add, Madam Chair, because it has come up as a question in the other body, this is a process that has been used by the largest regulatory licensing board in our Department of Commerce for about 20 years. It is very safe, very efficient, and has been tried and proven. Sections 10 and 11 add a second person, actually sort of a third in a way. The board already states that they can designate certain things to the executive administrator or another board member. They also are adding here an additional other person. That additional other person if the executive administrator were out of town, licensing would likely be the licensing supervisor themselves. So not just the license examiner, but the supervisor of that section. This will help streamline license approvals between those quarterly, four times a year, board meetings for clean, complete licenses. Madam Chair, you will hear, I hope, from hospitals who will tell you they spend thousands of dollars recruiting physicians, and while they're waiting for that license approval, those physicians find other jobs in other states, and we lose them. I shared with a group of clinic managers the contents of this bill about a month ago, and the room exploded in applause. They also see the problems with the backlog. Right now, according to the division, there's approximately 290 licenses in backlog right now. So some of these may not be complete. In fact, I've heard from the division that, frankly, only about 5% of the license applications are submitted complete. The department is also looking at some improvements in that whole application process, and perhaps you'll hear about that from the department today. So this process will streamline the approval of licenses. So that's topic number one in the bill, and it's an important issue for the Board of Medicine. The second issue has to do with those folks helping them out in doctors' offices, and that was the second item on that list of whys. So first of all, in about the mid-1990s, physician offices began to hire unlicensed folks to do routine medical duties. So right now, you go into your doctor's office, and some nice young person, usually they're young anyway, takes your blood pressure, takes you to the room, asks you your medical history, gets your medication history. Those are unlicensed folks. In the old days, it used to be RNs and LPNs, licensed people. But in about the mid-1990s, to reduce overhead costs, physicians' offices began to move to these unlicensed people. The problem is that their own laws prohibit the delegation of any kind of medical duties to an unlicensed person. So this bill corrects that gap in their laws. It will make it authorized for a physician to delegate to an unlicensed person routine medical tasks. That's the term used in the bill in Section 3. The board itself will define what those routine medical tasks are. Should I pause, Madam Chair?
No, I think we can proceed. Thanks.
I had a question, but that's okay.
Please. All right. So the board itself will determine what those routine medical tasks are. Typically, it's taking a blood pressure, getting a patient history. But this would then correct those medical statutes to allow this delegation. So you see that in Section 3. Then in Section 6, 12, and 14, it adds some additional cleanup language. It puts the delegation of routine medical duties under the exception to the license to practice medicine. As I said, right now, the law prohibits any of these medical activities from being delegated to unlicensed people. This is where we correct that in Section 6. In Section 12, it adds medical assistant to the practice of medicine. And lastly, in Section 14, it adds medical assistance to the definition of medical professional under the Title 12 criminal procedure. So, pretty basic. Probably the type of things they'll be approved to do is what they're doing right now. But this simply is a cleanup, making those duties legal. So then, going on, there's a second category of medical assistant created in this bill, again, to correct a problem that was identified by physicians who are practicing in offices. You all remember, I believe, Senate Bill 74, that was Medicaid reform. And then we had a bill a couple years ago that dealt with opioids. And in those bills, of course, we made more robust the prescription drug monitoring program. And in the legislation, we prohibited certain people from looking into that database because it contains sensitive information about individual Alaskans. That legislation was very specific. No unlicensed person could look into the database. Well, now we have a problem in medical offices, particularly pain doctors' offices. And I found this out when I was at a Cancer Society meeting last summer. There was a pain doctor there presenting, and there were a couple other legislators there with me, and we got a good chewing out because of that prohibition for them. Mm-hmm. What it means for a pain doctor particularly, or a cancer doctor, is he's seeing patients, da-da-da-da-da, here's somebody that's going to be getting an opioid prescription, he has to stop what he's doing, go to his computer, and look that person up himself, because he has no licensed people in his office to whom he could delegate that task. So, this bill corrects that. That happens in, well, we'll get to the sections that it happens in, but the way to correct it is actually to create an entity of medical assistants who are certified. So there are recognized training and certification programs out there. The training programs, you see the two accrediting agencies. There are also national exams for certifying medical assistants. These are national exams that, again, coincide with these accredited education programs. Our own community colleges have programs right now educating certified medical assistants. And you see the different states that already recognize this particular licensed entity of a medical assistant. So in Section 4, the certifying process itself will be defined in regulation by the board. So they will identify what education they will require, what kind of certifying exams they will accept. There are several exams, and so maybe they're going to just pick a couple that they're going to approve, or maybe they'll elect to choose them all. There'll be a licensing fee, there'll be continuing education, and renewal of that certification. So the board will do all of that in regulation. There's also in Section 5 specific limitations on the use of that term certified. So medical assistants who have not achieved that higher education and certification will not be able to use that term. And in Section 13, you see the word certification is included in the definition of a license. So now these folks would be able to be asked to look into the PDMP on the part of a physician, and probably be assigned probably more complex medical duties. I have no jurisdiction over that. That will be up to the board itself. So, in summary, This will provide a more efficient, expeditious, and effective licensing of physicians. It will provide legal clarity for the delegation of routine medical duties to unlicensed people and create more stringent licensing for an entity that would be recognized as certified or licensed by the board. You see the word urgent need at the top, and I think I've pointed out some of the reasons that the state medical board really needs this. That delegation to unlicensed people, which is routinely happening now, really does need to be legally cleared up for their malpractice issues. So the board is extremely hopeful that this can be done this session. We've received no opposition to this board or to this bill, and you see the entities that are in support of it. And with that, Madam Chair, that is the sectional as well as the presentation of the bill.
Thank you for your thorough introduction. I believe we have a question from Representative Sullivan Leonard and then Keto.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Giesel. I think this is a real important bill, and much like yourself, I've heard from other medical professionals who have stated that really it's such a time element for them when they are seeing their patients, and they have so many acuity levels they have to follow, as well as time management between each patient, and the applicability of having either an RN, an LPN, or a CMA available to assist them in reviewing the opioid database or patients' charts or what have you is a crucial element to their support network. Mm-hmm. CMAs, and we've seen their role in different areas of, you know, healthcare. I think it'd be very, very beneficial. My question is, would the CMAs be able to actually apply a prescription for a patient? May they write out a script, or is it just for overview of the database?
Through the chair, Representative, they are going to not be allowed to do any kind of prescribing or management of opioids other than looking up in the database, is my understanding of the board's intent. But that will be left up to the board. I do want to mention a cautionary note, and it comes based on comments that you've made. The term CMA is actually a trademark, a registered trademark by one of the certifying bodies. And so you'll notice in the bill that term is not used, nor are the words certified medical assistant appearing in that order. Mm-hmm. We separate the words so that we don't violate this trademark.
Oh, very good.
Mm-hmm. Representative Keto.
Thank you, Madam Chair, through the chair. So, looking at the whole idea of a medical assistant, it appears as though we are providing for licensing of medical assistants or registration certification in this bill, but it also says we are allowing medical professionals to designate routine tasks to an unlicensed medical assistant. Do we have two classes of medical assistants, those that are licensed and those that are not?
Thank you for that question. Through the chair, Representative Keto. Absolutely, that is true. Two categories of medical assistants, one that is just a regular medical assistant and one that has sought ongoing education and taken that national certifying exam. So then they would pursue being actually licensed, certified by the board.
Follow up?
Proceed.
Through the chair, Senator Giesel. So I guess what I'm concerned about then is you have a doctor's office that might have an individual who is a certified medical assistant and they're providing opportunities or providing support in certain tasks. You have that same office that might have two other medical assistants that are not certified performing those same tasks. What is our ability to oversee whether or not those individuals are performing their duties in accordance with the training that they've received, because the unlicensed personnel have received no training?
Thank you for that question. Through the chair, Representative Keto, the board will define the limitations on those two entities. And, of course, as happens in all medical operations, it's up to that facility to make sure that their clinicians are practicing within the scope of their license. So there has been discussion by the State Medical Association, as well as I understand the State Medical Board, about, of course, there's probably going to be a pay differential between these folks, and perhaps some medical offices, some physician offices, won't want all of their medical assistants to be certified. They may want to just have one or two that are certified that, of course, would earn a higher pay. This is all logistics that the medical profession will work out.
Follow up.
Proceed.
Through the chair, Senator Giesel. So we've had some questions in Labor and Commerce about the applicability of, say, the naturopaths performing their duties in accordance with their education, allowing the board to do that oversight. The medical board is telling us that the naturopath board or naturopath organization cannot oversee those activities, and it needs to be in statute, but yet the medical profession now is asking that we authorize a new category of medical professional, and I, for one, don't know what that medical professional will be authorized to do. I don't know what the educational requirements are. We're asked or being asked to leave it entirely up to the board. At the same time, that same profession is telling us that other boards can't do that. Do you have a comment about that?
Representative Quito, through the chair, you are identifying an ongoing and large encompassing turf situation that occurs in medicine, whether it's between physicians and nurses or naturopaths or you name it. So yes, you're right. I will say, again, going back to the nursing board, which I happen to be closely familiar with, we did the same thing in getting in our statutes the authority to delegate to unlicensed assistive personnel, because as a nurse practitioner in a physician office, I was now confronted with medical assistants who were not licensed, and I was prohibited from delegating to them until my board put in statute and in regulation the authorization for me to delegate certain tasks, and there's actually lists in regulation that I can delegate to the unlicensed person. So we do trust professional boards to do this. It's pretty routine.
Thank you. And just kind of a closing or a comment I'd like to make. And I guess I do appreciate that there are areas of turf, but I also think that we need to be very careful about what we're adding and understanding what we're adding. And I guess I have a concern about allowing for this new certification of medical assistants without really understanding what the medical assistants are supposed to be tasked with doing. And I guess the other final comment on this is really in looking at trying to provide for efficiencies or making it easier for doctors and medical professionals to practice their profession, I really would like a commitment that this is going to result in decreases in costs, because if we are delegating additional tasks that are right now supposed to be performed by the licensed professional to unlicensed individuals, it seems as though the costs for those services could go down substantially. But if the costs are going to stay the same or go up, my concern is that money is going into the pockets of those medical professionals. The public is not receiving a benefit. So I guess I just put that out there for consideration.
Thank you, Representative Quito, through the chair. I appreciate your comments. And actually, we should have seen those cost reductions back in the mid-1990s when medical assistants began to replace RNs and LPNs in physician offices.
And I guess we've seen medical costs continue to increase since then. So
it's an interesting comment, Representative Quito. I would just note that we did just add this requirement that healthcare providers use the PDMP in the last few years, and so we added additional work to them at a time when they're not actually able to bill that the looking up of information in a PDMP and being able to delegate that to an appropriate personnel is helpful. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On that same point, I just want to understand this a little bit better, because I was just thinking, when I think of maybe like the assistant in the office, I'm thinking, and this is partly probably from teaching at UAA, seeing a lot of students who want to come in and they have been working in medical offices without really any training. And I'm just wondering if they put that, this particular requirement, are we sort of professionalizing that position a little bit? Because, or am I thinking of the wrong person? I hope I'm articulating that well so you can answer that.
Good question, Representative Tarr, through the chair. You're right. The I'm going to say regular medical assistant that has been in existence now for a couple decades were typically on-the-job trained high school graduates. Over time, you may have noticed advertisements on the television from various community colleges saying, we train certified medical assistants. So the education became more formalized over time. The state of Alaska has not recognized that formalized education, but now because of the PDMP and what we've placed in law, it creates a need to recognize that.
And if a follow-up. Mm-hmm. And so it does sound like then we are, you know, we're sort of professionalizing it a little bit more than it has. And I guess I think in some ways there is a positive, there could be a positive benefit to that in terms of just, you know, people being better prepared to provide information and that type of thing. Because, like I say, in my experience, it's been a lot of folks, that's been more like an administrative job rather than a person with a background in biology or, you know, any other kind of science, healthcare related thing. So, so this may go back to that trademark issue where we sort of use it in common language as a medical assistant versus a certified medical assistant or a person who actually has the formal training for that position.
Representative Tarr, through the chair, what you've said is absolutely accurate. I will suggest that probably for the certified medical assistant, you will see them doing more invasive, I'm going to call it invasive procedures, that is being assigned the task of giving your child their injection, okay, their immunization. Mm-hmm. When you have people that don't have that professional training of when you take a medication out, you check the label, you check the prescription, you check the dose, and then you do it again before you administer it to the patient who you double check in identifying. I have worked in situations where when these medical assistants were first coming into practice, those kinds of safeguards were not being put in place because these folks were not as carefully trained. And so I look forward to us recognizing that more professional recognition, education, and licensing.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry, one just more follow-up. Proceed. and I was thinking about Representative Keto's questions, and I think raised some good points. But once this, if this bill were to go through, the board would then draft regulations, and there would be a public comment period and a lot of engagement, I would imagine, from the medical community if there were things that seemed overly burdensome in terms of the requirements for that position or inappropriate or something like that. I guess, I mean, that seems like a realistic expectation that people would kind of be keeping an eye on that.
Representative Tarr, through the chair, absolutely true. You know that the regulatory process takes approximately a year. So let's say the bill gets signed in June, for example, it will be the next year, June, before that regulatory process is due because or is completed because the board will have to write these things. Mm-hmm. Now, they've already been looking at what kinds of limitations they would put, but then it goes out for public comment, and all of us get those notifications so we can actually check on what the board is authorizing these folks to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
All right, and Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. Couple of questions. So the first was in Section 4, and I'm just wondering, there's the immunity that's being given, and I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more about what's driving that. Are there instances where you have, you know, whistleblowers being punished for blowing the whistle, or is there anything you can share with the committee as far as what's behind that?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, could you identify? Oh, you're seeing. I see what you're seeing. Section 0864109. Yes, this is pretty standard language in healthcare statutes. It appears in nursing statutes. So it's actually, let me just take a look here. Is this a whole new section, or does that? Yeah, this is a new section. But this just provides, for immunity for folks giving, reporting incidences.
Okay.
Very standard language.
And follow up?
Proceed.
So, and immediately below that, and I know you'd mentioned the issues with trademark for CMA. Now, my initial reading of Section 0864.111 is that if you are certified as a medical assistant in this chapter, that you could use the, you know, abbreviations capital M, capital or capital C, capital M, capital A. And is that the intent, or does, I just want to make sure that that wouldn't run afoul of the trademark issue you mentioned earlier.
Representative Eastman, through the chair, that is up to the medical board. If they choose to use the certifying body that holds the trademark on those three initials appearing in that sequence, then that particular medical assistant who went through that particular certifying body would be able to use those initials. But we do not specifically call out those initials or title in the bill.
Okay, thank you. And final question?
Proceed.
Through the chair. So I'm in Section 12, just a question on drafting. Now, the certified medical assistant is being exempted from being in violation of practicing medicine without a license. And I'm just wanting to know from a drafting perspective, if they're exceeding the are we intending for them to practice medicine?
Representative Eastman, for the through the chair, this section indicates that the practice without a license, except for a medical assistant, etc., licensed under this another chapter of this title, they are exempt. So what this is saying is that the medical assistant is recognized in another part of the statute and will be allowed to perform certain medical procedures. So this is removing that penalty from them for practicing without a medical license.
Okay, thank you. And is there is that other chapter then provide a similar comparable penalty if they were to violate that license?
There are penalties for practicing medicine without a license. Representative Eastman, through the chair, you see here the list of other folks that the State Medical Board provides licenses or certificates for, that being the physician assistant as well as the mobile intensive care paramedic.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Keto.
Thank you. And through the chair, Senator Giesel, in respect to Section 14, where we talk about a definition of medical professional, I guess I have a concern that if we have defined a medical assistant as somebody without licensing or training, and this identifies a medical assistant is considered a medical professional, I'm concerned about that definition allowing somebody who has no medical training to be considered a medical professional.
Representative Keto, through the chair, I understand your point. You will also see in this list the X-ray technician or anyone who holds a substantially similar position. So, yes, this is a rather broad definition. You'll see a nurse aide in there. This is, in the nursing profession, very, very similar to a medical assistant. Mm-hmm. But very, very limited certificate. Again, not licensed with what a registered nurse or licensed practical nurse would have, but a certificate that is the equivalent of a license. So this is a broad list of medical professionals, but appropriate for the medical assistant to be there.
Follow up. I guess I was looking at that in terms of we identify the dentist, the dental hygienist, but we don't identify a dental assistant, which can be delegated to tasks from a dentist mm-hmm. in the same way that we're saying a physician mm-hmm. can delegate a task to a medical assistant. We include a dental hygienist that has education requirements, that has to go through some kind of training. And for most of the others, it does seem that. I think the X-ray technician seems like it's a one out that there is actually a bill to license radiologic technicians, so they may be licensed in the future. But we're putting somebody in who has zero training or the allowability of somebody to be considered a medical professional who has zero training, and that concerns me. So I just put that out there.
And I completely respect your point, Representative Quito, through the chair. As a fellow licensed professional, as an engineer, I know you're looking at the specifics here, and I get your point. The purpose of this definition of medical professional is to authorize those routine medical tasks, and we haven't specified here that medical assistant who got certification, which really is analogous to an x-ray technician, you know, higher education type thing. So it simply includes them. Your point about the the dental assistant, perhaps they should be added.
Yeah.
But I leave that to another bill.
Probably. Yeah. All right. Any other questions for Senator Giesel? Right, that certainly was a lively conversation. Thank you very much. I think at this point in time, we'll move on to invited testimony. I believe that Deputy Commissioner Fred Parity from DCCED would like to testify. Welcome.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Fred Parity. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, and I'm before you today to testify in support of this bill on behalf of the department. I first want to express my appreciation to Senator Giesel for bringing this bill. She's had a long-time commitment to these issues, and her professional insight is deeply appreciated. I next want to note my pleasure in testifying for the first time before the newest member of the House. And I lastly want to note the chairman's admonition in her opening remarks about time. And Lisa and I have taught our daughter the meaning of the word alacrity, which she defines as chop, chop, hurry up. So here we go. Alaska's demand for healthcare professionals continues to increase. In fiscal year 17, the division processed 22% more medical licenses and 31% more nursing licenses than in 16. And in the current fiscal year, we've already received more applications in year to date, roughly 8 months, than we did in the previous fiscal year in the entire year. We, to address this growing application volume, we at the department initiated a strategic planning process, and we identified streamlining the application process for healthcare professions as our highest priority. That initiative included a comprehensive examination of our processes, the classic whiteboard where you rack out your process and you identify every step in it, by a team of state employees who are daily in the trenches to identify those roadblocks and bottlenecks. I think we called them rubs, and they identified 27 rubs in the process. Then we evaluated the cause of each problem to determine whether it was a public safety need, whether the process was simply outdated or even obsolete. One of the details in that was we had a requirement that a notary stamp be on the photo. Well, notaries are taught not to put a notary stamp onto a photo, and that really doesn't provide any public safety because they're just stamping that the person in front of them is that, not that the person in front of them is in fact the applicant. And then whether the rub could be simplified. So we initiated a three-pronged approach to implementing solutions to those identified rubs. Part of them were in board regulation. Part of them were improvements to our IT process. We are in the process of going live with upgrades to our IT where you can complete the original application online. That's currently not possible. It's only renewals. It's going to be set up like the PFD so that you can't go to the next question without having answered the original question. As you recall from Senator Giesel's testimony, something less than 10%, 5% of the applications come in the door complete. That's because they're voluminous and complex. By adding that check as you go through the process, we hope to upgrade the receipt of completed applications. And finally, the third bucket was changes to statute, which is what is before you in this bill and why we support the bill. Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'd be glad to take questions.
All right, Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. With regard to, I think it was one or two positions that this bill is seeking for processing, would that come out of receipts then that the medical board
Yes, ma'am.
Provides?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there any other questions for Deputy Commissioner Parity? All right. Seeing none, thank you very much. All right. I think that's it for invited testimony. We also have Deborah Stovern and Janie Hoveden available for questions in case people have any questions. All right. We're going to go ahead and open up the bill for public testimony now. Is there anybody in the room that would like to testify? All right. Seeing none, we're going to go to the off-net. We have Dr. Danny Robinett from the Foundation Health Partners, Fairbanks Memorial Hospital in Fairbanks.
Hi, good afternoon, and thanks to the chair and to the committee members for the opportunity to testify. Representing healthcare organization in Interior Alaska, we strongly support this bill. We've had struggles. Recruiting physicians is difficult everywhere, and particularly in Alaska and Fairbanks. And unfortunately, we've lost over the last 2.5 years for sure two candidates to other positions while they're awaiting a license completion. So we strongly support this, the work that the department is doing to streamline the process. This has led to us suffering with an open position in cardiology for about 2 years. We've paid temporary doctors to help fill the gap in the meantime, and that is rapidly approaching six figures in cost to us due to some of the delays. Fortunately, we've recently, I think, filled that position or at least have an agreement for that, but we do strongly support expediting the process as much as possible. Also, to be sure and understand that we agree it's important for it to be safe, and I think the safeguards in the bill are very clear about making sure this is a clean application that doesn't have any questionable issues in it that need investigation. And I'd certainly be happy to take any questions at this time.
Are there any questions? All right, seeing none, thank you very much for calling in to testify today. All right, I believe that's our only public testimony on this bill today, so I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. Are there any amendments to SB 108? All right, is there any discussion?
Can we take a brief at ease now?
Sure. Discussion on this bill? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this will be an important step forward, and I hope that it will end up resulting in more access to care that could help lower costs, as Representative Quito had mentioned. And I thought there was good discussion around sort of the common language around medical assistant and the professional person who's going to fill the role of medical assistant. And I think it, you know, be imperative on the responsibility of us to watch for those regulations when they come out and sort of understand that better and then make sure there aren't any, you know, kind of issues there. But I appreciate the effort that's going to move forward with this bill.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to thank the bill's sponsor for bringing this forward. I've heard concerns from physicians, both in my district and others, about the PDMP requirement. And so being able to create this, you know, this new category and get this moved so quickly will allow healthcare practitioners to be, you know, really efficient in their offices, particularly since we've created this new, reporting standard, which is very important, and we want to make sure that they're able to adhere to it. I also think the temporary licensing piece is important. We've heard from employers that this is something that they need to do, and sounds to me like there's some appropriate fail-safe. So there's a committee will this bill after, should it move from this committee, this bill will move on to Labor and Commerce, where I'm sure Representative Quito will have additional comments as well. I would entertain a motion if there were one.
Madam Chair, I move the Senate Finance Committee substitute for sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 108, Work Order 30-LS0740/I from Committee with Individual Recommendations and attached fiscal note.
Are there any objections? All right, seeing none, committee substitute for SB 108 passes from committee. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the paperwork. Thank you very much, Senator Senator Giesel and your aide, Jane Conway. Go ahead and turn our attention to the confirmation hearing for Dr. Sang-Lee Liu from Nome to the Alaska State Medical Board. Let's see, where is she? Dr. Liu, would you please? All right, fantastic. Would you please introduce yourself and tell us about your qualifications for the State Medical Board?
Okay. My name is Sailing Liu, S-A-I-L-I-N-G, last name is L-I-U. I'm board-certified family practice physician, and I have been practicing medicine, the full spectrum of family practice in Nome, Alaska, Norton Sound for 28 years. And I have been the medical director for the long-term care facility. We have 18 beds, the long-term care, and I have been on the state medical board for the past 4 years, so this is my second term. Mm-hmm. And the reason I continue, because we have a lot of turnover for the medical board, and I think it's very important to have continuation the service. And it's an honor and just very awesome responsibilities to be on the board. It's a lot of work. And I work with a group of people very dedicated and took the responsibilities very serious, because we really have to safeguard the physician that comes to our state and safeguard the medical safety for the entire state. So even like last board meeting in February, we know the state has budgets cut. The travel was not approved, but everybody showed up. They paid their own way, you know, from different parts of the state, and then went to Anchorage and had a board meeting, because we only meet four times a year, and there's a lot of issues to discuss and to take care of. And so it is just a privilege and an honor to be on the board.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and also for your willingness to serve a second-year term. It is a lot of work. Are there any questions for Dr. Liu? All right. Seeing none.
Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Tarr.
Thank you. Thank you for your interest in this, continuing on this board. There's one question I have that's related, and I don't know if you were listening to the earlier conversation about the bill we just heard related to licensure, and one of the things that came up was wondering if there is full participation from the current board members, or if getting a quorum is ever an issue for meetings, because I was just wondering if that's ever a reason that business would be slowed down or approvals of license applications would be slowed down. And it caught my interest when you said that even though the travel wasn't approved, people still opted to use their own personal funds to travel to the most recent meeting. Is it the general practice, is it standard that all members do attend the meetings and getting a quorum isn't an issue?
No, it's not an issue. Most it's about one person occasionally not being able to, because the schedule not being able to attend. But most of the time we have majority of people, like everybody was there, attend.
And then just as
the issue we discussed is very, you know, it's very, very important. Mm-hmm. We just like to be, you know, take the thing seriously and participate in discussion.
And you had said that part of your interest in remaining on the board is because there is a lot of turnover. So what it sounds like is while someone's appointed, they're very active and do participate in all the meetings, but are they only serving one term in a lot of instances?
am serving one term, most of them serving two terms, but the term is up. So in the past 2 years, there's a lot of term up. So that's why there's at least about 4 or 5 turnover there.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Are there any other questions for Dr. Liu? All right. Representative Zolkowski.
Madam Chair, I move that the Health and Social Services Committee forward Dr. Liu's name to a joint session of the legislature for consideration for confirmation to the Alaska State Medical Board, keeping in mind that this forwarding does not reflect intent by any committee members to vote for or against this individual during a confirmation session.
Are there any objections? All right. Seeing none, Dr. Liu, your name has been forwarded for full consideration of a confirmation vote. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. And with that, I'm going to invite up my aide, Ms. Bernice Nesbitt, to come forward, put yourself on the record, and give us a brief recap of H. Bill 358.
Sure. For the record, Bernice Nesbitt, staff to Representative Ivy Sponholz, District 16. So before you should be House Bill 358, Insurance Coverage for Telehealth, and we should be looking at 30-LS1216-J. So under this bill, insurers will reimburse health care services delivered via telehealth by a provider who is licensed in the state. No initial in-person encounter is necessary, and all of this language is in Section 1. And Section 2 defines healthcare insurer and telehealth, which has the same definition in Title 47. Section 3 states that the insurance plans affected by Section 1 of this bill will apply on or after the effective date of July 1st, 2019. In Section 4, the effective date is July 1st, 2019. And that's the end of the brief summary of the bill and all the sections. And so far, we have not received any opposition. And there are 3 providers online who are available for questions.
All right. Fantastic. Thank you, Ms. Nesbitt. Are there any questions for Ms. Nesbitt? All right. Seeing none, we're going to go ahead and we're going to turn to invited testimony on HB 358, and it looks like we have Dr. Aram Evans from the Behavioral Health Network first, the Orion Behavioral Health Network.
Yes, I'm just grabbing Dr. Evans now to join the meeting. I am on right now.
All right. Dr. Evans, can you introduce yourself for the record and then give us your testimony?
Absolutely. Yeah, my name is Dr. Aram Evans. I'm the medical director of Orion Behavioral Health Network, which is a group of providers that take care of children and adolescents for psychiatric and mental health services around the state, providing services via both in-person and telemedicine. I'm Alaska WAMI student, went through the University of Washington, and have been practicing in Alaska since 2004 after completing a residency and fellowship down in California.
All right, did you have some testimony?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I wasn't sure if I had said enough. So I just wanted to put out support for, you know, expanding the definitions and supporting the payment of telemedicine in Alaska. It is an extremely important service for a lot of our clients. They reside in villages that don't have roads to them in groups of, you know, 50 to 200, and the reality of getting any services out there for mental health care without the use of telemedicine, it's just not realistic to have a psychiatrist or a child and adolescent psychiatrist fly or reside in any of those communities on a regular basis. And so this is really their only lifeline to be able to do that. And sometimes they will have private insurance and the private insurance may not pay for the telehealth, which leaves the families in a very difficult position of either having to pay out of their pocket, fly thousands of miles, or withhold the care that would be helpful. Tends to drive up the care costs in the state of Alaska if you neglect a mental health issue until it becomes large and then go to the emergency room or to an inpatient hospital. So I just wanted to put out support that I think it's a money-saving thing for the state of Alaska to get as many private insurers to pay for telehealth as possible. It also helps defer the costs for people that are dual insured that have private insurance as well as Medicaid. If the private insurance does not pay for the service, then that burden of covering that service goes to the state in form of Medicaid payment. So I just wanted to voice a strong support of moving forward on this bill and appreciate that it has been introduced.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Dr. Evans? Representative Zelkowski?
Thank you, Dr. Evans. Can you just help me understand the context of your understanding of this issue in terms of, does the Orion Behavioral Health Network partner with Alaska providers that have encountered this as a challenge?
So we have Alaska providers in our network. So we have four PAs. We have two psychiatrists that I'm one of them. I fly to Alaska. And so we have encountered a lot of difficulty in getting services paid for both our Alaska providers that are physically present in Alaska, providing telehealth to the rural communities, as well as getting services paid for by our out-of-state providers that are telehealthing into communities. So both of them have been a difficulty. I had hoped with last year, with the passage of House Bill 234, that was going to resolve, but it has not as of yet. Some payers are paying and some payers are not paying. And sometimes even the same payer will have different responses on a case-by-case basis. Sometimes they'll pay and sometimes they won't pay, and that doesn't appear to be rhyme or reason. So it'd be really helpful to have as much backing as we could to say, oh, hey, you got to look at the statutes that you really are required to pay for this service.
All right. Are there any other questions for Dr. Evans? All right. Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony today. Next, we're going to move on to Linda Freedom with Mind Matters in Anchorage.
Yes, Madam Chair, committee members, for the record, my name is Dr. Lynn Freeman. I am representing my own private practice today, Mind Matters Research. And I wanted to share with you that I'm very much in support of the changes and the information that you continue in this bill. Before 234 was passed, there were multiple patients who needed to be treated and were not able to. To give you a little bit of information about my practice, essentially, I treat patients who are only those that are referred to me by physicians because that patient has a chronic disease and the physician has identified that there are either behavioral or emotional issues that are contributing to a worsening of their condition. And then I step in and I practice various forms of integrative approaches, non-pharmacological pain management, whatever is needed to help that patient get better. So about 60% of my practice is in person, and about 40% is at a distance and with telehealth. And that is because, you know, there are patients that are pain patients or maybe in the last stages of cancer that even if they could travel, it would be extremely painful, or they cannot drive because they have seizures. So seeing the state move forward in a way to support patients and being able to get the care that they need where they need it, I think that is incredibly important, and I'm so pleased. And I also wanted to point out that in addition to my private practice, I've done over 10 years of NIH-funded research to actually create psychological interventions for patients with chronic diseases and to test them as live delivery versus telehealth. And as has been it was both pointed out in my research and in my colleagues who have done similar versions of research, essentially the improvement is equivalent. You can deliver treatment and get the same outcomes by doing it as telehealth or telemedicine as you can by having someone in your office when it comes to the mental health interventions. Also, around ethical issues, I've been really careful to keep myself trained and attend many hours of training on ethics and the use of telehealth in the mental health area. And there is a, you know, when you have consultants and need psychiatrists or others to step in from outside, absolutely that needs to happen. But in the ethics training that I received, they point out that to the degree it's possible, it's preferable to treat people in your own state and when you're licensed in that state, and if someone moves, to as quickly as possible transition them to a caregiver in the state they're moving to. And that is because you may not know the resources, so that if something were to happen as you're treating someone at a distance, if you do not know exactly who to call and when and how to intervene, you can be in a difficult situation. And one example of a patient that I treated recently who had misinterpreted her medication dosage, and when I came online and began working with her, I became aware that she was impaired, was able to have her show me what she took, immediately text the physician who had referred her to me, and determine what was safe and in her best interest at that moment. So I think it is very important to be licensed and to treat within your community unless there is, you know, only a different option that you truly need from outside, and the ethics training are pointing to that. That does not suggest that consults and the need for psychiatrists and others from outside should be in any way impaired. So I just wanted to share that information. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Dr. Freeman? All right. Seeing none, thank you for your testimony today. And next we will go to Victoria Knapp, the Chief Operating Officer with the Mat-2 Health Services. Ms. Knapp? All right, maybe we don't have Ms. Knapp. And with that, we'll open up the bill for public testimony. Bam. Is there anybody in the room who'd like to testify? Brilliant. All right, this is just keeping up with our efficiency today. There's nobody online, so I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. Are there any amendments to HB 353? I'm sorry, did I do the right number? Yeah, 358. Representative Eastman.
Well, I have a question,
mm-hmm.
And I guess it would be to the sponsor. What is the scope of the benefits being provided? We're making it clear that an in-person contact, at least in some cases, isn't required between a patient and a provider.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see here in the language of Section 1 anything to give me scope to what benefits are being provided. So where do I go to find that scope? A very broad understanding would be, now I don't have to go see a doctor for anything. I can just do it via telehealth. Is it quite that broad, or is there some more scope?
Well, to clarify, receiving medical care via telehealth does not mean that you're not seeing a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
You still see a doctor. You still have a medical provider that's delivering that care. It's just the way that you're delivering those services, and we've chosen not to limit the scope in this particular bill because there are because we felt that unnecessarily narrowed down the parameters in ways that weren't constructive. In previous bills that addressed telehealth, the parameters were fairly narrowly defined, and that's resulted in people not being able to receive services via telehealth. And as we're looking at sort of the brave new world of technology, I would not like to put limits on the creativity of healthcare providers based on our ability to imagine today here in the legislature what can be done and what can't be done. There are certainly practical limitations about what kinds of health care can be delivered via telehealth and what can't, and I think that I'd like to see the marketplace sort of develop in this way.
Mm-hmm. So to follow up on that, so what we're saying is that a health care insurance or insurer shall provide coverage for, and that could be taken to mean that you know, anything that they're providing benefits for right now without telehealth, they need to provide benefits for that via telehealth. Is that the direction we're going? Because that also is very broad.
It was intentionally broad. Okay. I'll just clarify that this was based on the concept behind this bill was based on my own experience not being able to access healthcare services via telehealth, which led us to exploring the concept of telehealth as it related to private insurance. And there are some healthcare providers and some healthcare insurers which cover it, but they're not all healthcare insurers are paying for that right now, and it's probably time to move that direction. All right, and it looks like actually we have Victoria Knapp is now available on the phone, and I'd like to give her a chance to testify. Ms. Knapp?
Hi, thank you for taking my testimony. It looks like we had some technical difficulties. I appreciate the opportunity to speak in support of House Bill 358. I am the Chief Operations Officer for Matsu Health Services in West Scylla. We provide FQHC primary care services as well as behavioral health services, and we moved to using a telemedicine model for some of our psychiatric evaluations and medication management appointments several years ago so that we could help meet the unmet need in the Matsu Borough for these services. It is very difficult to find people who practice psychiatry willing to come and work in the Matsu Borough, and so telemedicine was a solution for us to be able to continue to support the community and provide the necessary services. We are a safety net provider funded by the federal government and the Division of Behavioral Health, grant funded. We also bill insurance and Medicaid. And what we're finding is there are several large insurance providers in the state of Alaska who do not provide coverage for telehealth services, and so families and individuals are left with the choice of incurring a very large bill and paying it on their own or looking elsewhere for telehealth for psychiatry services. And we do have a sliding fee scale and accept payments, and we try and work with the families, but it's very frustrating when most of our people seeking our services can receive needed medications and evaluations here, but certain private insurers, large insurers in the state actually, do not cover telehealth psychiatry.
All right, are there any questions for Ms. Knapp? All right, seeing none, thank you. I'm glad we were able to work out the technical difficulties there. Thank you very much. All right. Are there any other points of discussion for the committee? All right. Seeing none, I would entertain a motion to move the bill from the committee.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 358, Work Order 30-LS1216, /J, from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
I object.
All right. Would you like to speak to your objection?
I would. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, as it happens, all of the health care that I receive through the Veterans Administration through my primary care doctor is all telehealth. Mm-hmm. And my doctor actually resides in Orlando. So I've never met him physically, but certainly I meet him over video and audio and whatnot. And I appreciate the value of telehealth, and I think that, like the VA, many providers are going in that direction. There's certainly cost savings to be gained there, but I don't know that the market is ready for us to mandate that any health care being provided now has to be accessible via telehealth. I think that if it makes sense financially that providers are going to go that direction, and there are probably some small number of situations where, and I've certainly run into them personally, where telehealth isn't everything that it could be. Mm-hmm. And if a healthcare provider wants to require that, you know, some number of procedures or whatever it is not be done by telehealth, I'd like to at least leave them that option. I don't know if the market's ready for quite that much of a change.
Are there any other comments?
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you. Just to kind of segue off that comment, do we have a list of what is approved then for telehealth medicine with regard to procedures and oversight for patients?
I don't. Ms. Nesbitt, do we have a lifeline?
Representative Sullivan Leonard, through the chair, there's actually a list that I found on the Alaska Native Medical Center's website because they've been doing telehealth for the past decade or maybe longer. But I could email the committee the list of procedures that they do if that would help answer your question. Mm-hmm. Or I could let you see the list currently.
Yeah, that's a different it's a different category. Did you want Ms. Marks? Did you have something to offer? All right, please. And put yourself on the record and answer the question.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Anna Latham. I'm the deputy director at the Division of Insurance, mm-hmm. and this bill is allowing for insurance companies to pay for telehealth services, essentially, to cover in the group and the individual markets. So the plans. The benefits that are already in the plans, which contain essential health benefits, and then other any other benefits that the plans cover would be allowable for telehealth. Mm-hmm. So the list of benefits for the Alaska Native Health Plans, that's a separate program altogether.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask
a clarifying question? Yeah. Ms. Representative Zolkowski.
So just a clarifying question, thank you, ladies, is this bill does not mandate that an individual utilize telehealth services. It just provides the authorization for the insurance plans to be billed for those services. Is that correct?
Representative Zolkowski, through the chair, that is absolutely correct. There's no mandate. It allows insurance companies to cover telehealth services beyond mental health. Mm-hmm. Which is what's currently in statute.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. And so if there's some type of something that I can get through my health care plan now and I want to do that through telehealth, is this now basically saying that the insurer has to provide that telehealth option?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, it's saying that the insurer can pay for that if you utilize telehealth instead of having a face-to-face visit with your doctor.
Mm-hmm. Follow up. So I'm trying to understand what the word shall means in this specific context. Can you give me a little bit more detail? One way of reading it would be that if I want to do something via telehealth, the insurer's got to do it via telehealth, or at least give me that as an option. Is that not the way to read it?
Representative Eastman, through the chair, it's saying that they shall provide coverage for benefits provided through telehealth, and it may or may not require in-person contact. So it's simply allowing large, small group, and individual market coverage to pay for telehealth services.
So to clarify, we're not requiring that people use telehealth. We're requiring insurance companies to cover telehealth services should your plan, you know, have a provision for such services. An example might be there are some kinds of services which don't make sense to deliver via telehealth. There are other services that do make sense to deliver via telehealth. But right now, a lot of plans that are offered in the state of Alaska in the private market are not required to cover telehealth. There are reasons why telehealth can provide more access to services. Sometimes via distance is a reason why you'd want to require coverage for telehealth so that somebody doesn't have to, say, fly into Anchorage for an initial visit with a health care provider, which is what is currently required in law, they can just initiate a doctor-patient relationship with a health care provider via distance and have a distance relationship that way. There are other times when, for example, in my health care provider's office, they prefer that you don't come into the office when you have the flu, and one of the providers there now offers telehealth visits. So that if you have the flu, instead of having to come into the office when you're sick and then risk, you know, contaminating everybody else in the office with your flu virus, you can have a telehealth visit, you know, and they can determine what your course of action should be from there. So we're not saying what kind of health care should be covered. We're saying that health care should be, you should be able to have your insurance provider pay for it when it's delivered via telehealth.
Okay, a follow-up on that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in my case, the VA is doing all sorts of stuff, telehealth, that I wouldn't have necessarily expected mm-hmm. they would, but, mm-hmm. you know, it makes sense to them to do it. So where can I go, maybe as a consumer, to find out what sort of things are available by telehealth? Mm-hmm. And if one insurer decides to provide something by telehealth, do all other insurers need to be, you know, able to match that?
That is a decision that is between you and your healthcare provider, Representative Eastman. And I think, actually, in the interest of time, I'm going to go ahead and call the question because I believe that there are two members of the committee that have to go. So I'd like to, if you'd continue to maintain your objection, we'll just go ahead and call the roll.
Okay. Yeah, I do.
All right. Let's call the roll.
Representative Keto.
Yes.
Representative Zolkowski.
Yes.
Representative Eastman?
No.
Representative Johnston?
Yes.
Representative Sullivan Leonard?
Yes.
Representative Tarr?
Yes.
Chair Sponholz?
Yes.
6 yeas, 1 nay.
All right, and with that, the bill passes. We're going to take a very brief at ease to sign the paperwork, and then we're going to have up our last item on the agenda. That, we're back on the record with Representative Ledoux and Lisa Avat. Please come forward and put yourself on the record with you. Introduce your legislation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Gabrielle Ledoux, and I represent District 15, and that is Muldoon and Jaber. And with me today is my aide, Lisa Vaught, who's been working on this with me. So, Madam Chair, thank you, and thank you all members of the committee, of the Health and Social Services Committee, for hearing this important piece of legislation. Parents play such a critical role in the development and growth of their children. It is critical that parents are involved in the actions and decisions affecting their children, and the rights of parents should be consistently supported by the legislature. It is for the rights of parents that I've sponsored HJR 32. This joint resolution would, if approved by two-thirds of both bodies of the legislature and approved by the voters of Alaska, add a new section to the state constitution allowing the legislature or the people through the initiative process to require notification and or consent of the parent or legal guardian of a minor before the minor's pregnancy is terminated. HJR 32 in and of itself does not require parental notification or consent. It simply enshrines in the Constitution the principle of parental rights, assuring that efforts made by the people or by their representatives in the legislature are not invalidated by a constitutional challenge. This happened in 2016 when the Alaska Supreme Court invalidated the 2010 ballot initiative that changed state law and required parental notification and consent, upsetting the will of the 56% of the voters who supported the initiative. Thank you for your time and consideration of this important resolution.
All right, thank you. Are you going to do a sectional?
Well, we don't really have a sectional.
No.
Okay.
It's really, really simple. The first section says that Article 1 of the Alaska Constitution is amended by adding a new section to read, Section 26, Notice and Consent Before Termination of a Minor's Pregnancy, saying this Constitution does not prohibit the legislature or the people from requiring notice to and the consent of the parent or legal guardian of a minor before the minor's pregnancy is terminated. The legislature shall implement this section by law in a manner consistent with the requirements of the Constitution of the United States, and the people may implement this section by initiative in a manner consistent with the requirements of the Constitution of the United States. Section 2 reads, the amendment proposed by this resolution shall be placed before the voters of the state at the next general election. And that's it.
All right. Thank you. And at this time, we're going to go ahead and set HJR 32 aside. I thank you for your time today. Next week in House Hess, we are going to hear SB 169 by Senator Giesel regarding supervision for behavioral health providers. And on Thursday, we'll be hearing a presentation from Casey Family Programs on the child welfare system in Alaska. The time is 5:20. This hearing of House Health and Social Services Committee is now adjourned.
Thank you.